Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 16th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 8th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. For tickets and information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Doug Duncan. Doug is Fannie Mae's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist. He is responsible for providing all forecasts and analysis on the economy, housing, and mortgage markets for Fannie Mae. Duncan also oversees corporate strategy and is responsible for strategic research regarding external factors and their potential impact on the company and the housing industry. Doug was named one of Bloomberg Businessweek's 50 most powerful people in real estate and one of Inman News' 100 most influential real estate leaders for 2013. Prior to joining Fannie Mae, Duncan was Senior Vice President and Chief Economist at Mortgage Bankers Association. Doug, welcome back to our show.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
We're very excited to have you on the panel, and interesting year for real estate in the sense that what I felt would happen has not. It sort of just bounced along. And I took a good look at your sentiment index today as I wanted to talk to you. And it's interesting. I guess the first question is, when people have a certain sentiment, how does that play out in their actions? I guess that's the best way to start this.
Yeah, that's actually the one of the things that we work on. Is can we find data to match actions to attitudes? And so let me give you a couple of examples. There was a number of years ago a suggestion in many media accounts that the boomers liked to party. So when the kids moved out, they were going to sell their suburban homes and move downtown and buy condos and party the night away. Turns out not to be true.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually staying in their existing homes, and they're spending money refurbishing those homes. And at the time, surveys of those same people said, we intend to age in place. So they actually were matching their actions to their attitudes. In our current surveys of millennials, they all say, we intend to own a home. More than 90% intend to own a home. Just not now,
mm-hmm.
But part of that is because they haven't seen the income increases and the employment improvement that would put them in a position to buy. But of those who have formed households and are now renting, more than 50% are renting single-family homes, which in our mind is an action that aligns with their attitude about what they'll ultimately do.
So they have the willingness but lack the capacity right now.
Yeah, that's right. If you take the 25 to 34-year-old group, for example, and look at their median real or inflation-adjusted income and compare it to the same group 10 years ago, they are $8,000 less in real median household income. And their unemployment rate is higher than that same group 10 years ago. So they still have significant challenges.
And what's interesting about what you just said is going forward, how's that... This is sort of like an output gap, only it's an income gap. So how do you mm-hmm. make up for $8,000 and then go forward at the former pace? The chances are you don't.
Yeah, that's one of the questions is, will there be a catch-up? And so when people ask me when I'm out speaking what needs to be done, my view is there needs to be a shift in focus at the macroeconomic level to income production over income redistribution. Because it's very clear that when you put together, as you said, you looked at the HPSI, our home purchase sentiment index. The key variables that affect that are people's, two of the six are their income and their view of the stability of their employment.
Mm-hmm.
So those are rational issues for households.
They seem confident that they were going to have a job. That's pretty high score. That they weren't thinking they were going to lose their job. That's an improvement from where it was a few years ago.
Definitely, and you know, the 3 million jobs that were added in the economy last year, that is 2014, were a real confidence builder. And that process has continued this year as we look like we're on track to add maybe another 2.5 million. And that 25 to 34-year-old age group added jobs faster than all the other age groups. That's all good news for housing.
Are we adding jobs that pay what they need to pay for them to be able to qualify in this environment, in this lending environment? Are they making the kind of money that they can get a yes answer from a lender?
Well, on average, the answer is increasingly they are, but only incrementally. But this is not, we're not talking about there being a breakout with income growth because it is only incrementally improving. It would need to increase about half again as fast as it is for households to generate the confidence that that lenders would find them ready to get a yes on their mortgage. That said, there is a pickup in that space. We're seeing a pickup in first-time homebuyers in our data flow, but it's not at the pace that would be expected in the over the longer term.
It seems interesting that I've heard the issue of affordability being a problem, and we're at an interest rate that starts with a 4.
Well, part of it is local. You know, we always used to say all real estate's local. It's actually still true. You can go from change neighborhoods in the course of a quarter of a mile and find two different price profiles.
The counter to that, though, are all policies are usually national.
Yeah, well, that is one reason why historically in this country we've made it difficult to pass laws at the national level to change things because it has so many local deviations from local practice and structures. So, but even though interest rates are very affordable from an historical perspective, one of the questions is there an available supply in that market to take advantage of that interest rate? And, you know, you're in California, you've got some jurisdictions in California with 2 months supply. So there's simply not the available product for people who would be willing and able to buy at that interest rate to get into a home that fits their budget.
What's interesting about what you just said, and I'll give, Riverside has a pretty mild amount of inventory, say 3 months, bouncing around mm-hmm. there,
yeah.
But no pricing pressure at all.
So what's employment look like in the Riverside area?
You know, it's improved, but there's, again, what type of job? It's not construction. It used to be construction. So,
yeah.
So you have construction, you end up with migration, you end up with filled commercial and office and all that stuff. That job didn't show up this time. We're building at 20% of normal volume, 20%. Literally,
yeah.
Since 1960, we haven't built less homes.
Wow.
Other than we built more in 2015 than we did in 2014 and 2013. But if you talk a normal year, we're at 80% off. And
wow.
So that's still the overhang. So for Riverside, what that means is you have price stability at 3 months of inventory, which is a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the real issue there is the pickup in non-construction employment. If there is growth in the business community outside of the construction space, that would ultimately pull housing forward, probably.
Right, and what's interesting there is that we do have industrial doing very, very well. Prices are mm-hmm. very strong, and it has to do with, I guess, the logistic industry, which I'm just getting a handle on what that is. But that's big business in the Inland Empire due to availability of land, and you know, you can build mm-hmm. those gigantic structures. You know, I don't even know if it's like 200,000 square foot industrial boxes that they use for, you know, doing what they do. So that's the Inland Empire's gaining there, but it's just an unusual mix. And that's that first time buyer, you know, how long can we have an interest rate of 3 or 4%? That's just historically, yeah, it's not there.
That is true. If you take the 30-year fixed rate mortgage average from the end of World War II out to 2000, it was about 6.5%. If you take out the very high inflation in the last 5 years or so of the 1970s, it's about 6%. So we're still well below that long-term average. And housing did well across that time period, better at some points than others. But still, on average, we housed the American population with interest rates at that average level. The there are two things to think about. One is, how fast do you get to that level? If rates start to rise, do they rise rapidly to that level? If that happened, that would be very hard on housing, because housing does not do well in rapidly rising rate environments.
Unless it happens to be matched with wages, like 75 to 80.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's a correct observation.
But we don't have that.
If real incomes are rising along with that,
yeah,
then it's much less of an issue. Today, the concern is if the Fed changes its posture and rates rise and incomes don't rise, then will housing take a hit? Well, possibly, but that's the assumption that rates would rise. Our view is, if the Fed finally makes its move and raises short-term rates, long-term rates aren't going to go much of anywhere. Our forecast, in fact, for the fourth quarter of 2016 is that 30-year fixed rates will still be at 4.3%.
Yeah, I kind of saw that, and I was happy about that. And the 10-year T-bill was going to be, what, 2.4 or something like that?
Right. The global situation has a lot to do with this. China is clearly slowing. And even if you don't believe their internal statistics, you do have the measure of commodity prices around the globe, because they are the marginal demander of almost all the significant commodities.
Okay.
And the fact that those prices have fallen tells you that demand has dropped off significantly from China. That then rebounds to those countries that are resource intensive and slows their economies. And Europe has made no progress. Japan has made no progress. So the forecasts of global growth for the next couple of years are quite weak. That means, by comparison, the U.S. economy is the place to put your money. So we're seeing global capital flows to the U.S., which are holding down U.S. rates. And that will continue until such time as global growth picks up.
One of the concerns would be, let's say that, and this is why I mentioned that policies are national, California theoretically could do very well. Let's say if we did end up with construction and we ended up with migration because of that, et cetera, we could have quite a price run on the backs of an interest rate that starts with a 3. And that would be scary, because if you got to a place where, okay, the only way we can have this price is it's going to be attached to a 3% mortgage, then the future gets a little difficult.
Right.
And that's, you know, the Fed's got to look at that and say, okay, we're creating an asset bubble that can't survive a change.
Yeah, that's if you want to give your listeners a reading assignment, the president of the San Francisco Fed, John Williams, who's on the Federal Open Market Committee, wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago called Monetary Policy and House Prices. It's maybe 4 or 6 pages long. I think there might be one equation in it, which is easily understood. But he's raising the question of whether monetary policy is creating a bubble. He doesn't state it this way, but that's the inference in one of two ways. One is, if you think about the way we value assets using a discount rate and look at the discounted net present value of cash flows as the asset valuation, if interest rates are set at 0, the value of that asset is infinite. Now, interest rates in the relevant part of the yield curve aren't at 0, but they're very low, which could mean that those assets, and this might apply more to the multifamily space and those which are more of an investment-focused commodity, and asking whether or not those valuations might be overheated because of monetary policy. On the residential side, the question there is more so in the question of whether the pickup in employment and the what I believe are factors of workforce and regulation inhibiting the construction of supply, the supply through construction, are leading to unsustainable price increases in housing. And it's an interesting piece to read and think about if you are an investor or a potential investor. He raises some things that are worth thinking about.
Okay. Well, I know I'll definitely take advantage and read that. On what you just brought up, when someone has a portfolio of mortgages that are fixed, and something like 98% of the loans that are being written right now are fixed mortgages, and let's say they're at 4%, and going out in the future, let's say they're 6%, what happens to the value of that book of business, if you will?
Well, if they don't have some sort of a hedging strategy in their overall portfolio, they will see some valuation declines. That's one of the broad concerns about people who have significant investments, not just in mortgage-backed securities, but also in U.S. Treasuries, is that if there is a rate run-up, then prices decline on those assets, and that could spell trouble for folks.
When people buy in 2015, because part of the survey talks about it's a good time to buy or a good time to sell, is the buyer in 2015, are they looking at it as a profit motive, or are they looking at it, I want to own this home for lots of other reasons, nothing to do with money?
Well, I think because there are some tax policies that create incentives for people to think about the investment value, they don't ever completely exclude that. But I do believe that in today's environment, we're still close enough to the crisis that, and we've seen this actually in our survey data of consumers, they're more focused on the housing services aspect of owning a home, being able to control their own environment, being able to choose to live in an area that is suitable to their interests. Those attributes of the housing itself, as opposed to the investment attributes, are the dominant factors. Interestingly, the youngest people in the survey are the ones who feel the strongest about the investment potential of the house.
Okay. Maybe they didn't experience personally the downturn, so that's possible.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's also the case that they saw that the price decline was sufficient in some areas, that actually it's unlikely they would decline further, and there's mostly upside on the investment. We'll see whether that's true.
Because rents have been increasing, if you're a renter, is that a motivation? Because I noticed in the report that there was strong feeling that rents would increase much more than prices. But if they could lock in a payment, then rent increases for them are non-existent.
That's right, and they recognize that. So we ask them, is owning or renting preferred for lifestyle reasons? And then we also ask, is owning or renting preferred for long-term financial reasons? It's in both cases, the majority of young people say owning is preferred, but where the lifestyle piece is, a smaller share of them say owning is preferred. But when you track their life cycle, what you see is their responses suggest that's the case today because they're not married and they don't have children.
Mm-hmm.
So when they get married and they have children, then they go heavily into the owning preferred camp.
Not in your report, but dealing with the sentiment that's coming from policymakers, how is housing viewed at this point? Have we done enough downsizing of, there used to be almost 70% owners and now we're way back to where we were several decades ago? Do they feel enough is enough, or I'm glad we did that, we're back where we should be?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. There are a lot of stakeholders in the housing sector, and those who are advocates of policies on affordable housing would suggest it's gone too far, and the voice, their voice is starting to rise, that there needs to be policy action taken to create an expansion in the affordable housing space. The if you talk to the people that are worried about contingent liabilities to the taxpayer and their things like the GSEs, the reform of the GSEs, and of FHA and VA programs. So there's a group of stakeholders who would like to see reform take place to put the taxpayer at a distance from the potential losses. If you look at those who just feel that the role of the government was significantly expanded and needs to be as a matter of the way we run our economy, pulled back and more private capital put in place, there are those voices in the market as well. So there is still a spectrum of views. And today, I think that there's a balance in them, which is resulting in inaction, except perhaps on the regulatory front. Places like the CFPB and some of those who regulate industry processes.
Okay. We only have about a minute, 20 seconds left. Do you envision any tax policy changes, that might affect real estate ownership, like reducing the interest deduction or the $500,000 free taxable gain for a couple every 2 years, et cetera?
Well, I think it'll certainly get some discussion because the fiscal future of the country is not bright. In the short run, the next year or two, there aren't really issues, but then the size of the debt starts to expand again. And without reforms of entitlements and some adjustment in our fiscal policies, the future is going to be pretty difficult. So the any of the tax preferences, whether they're in real estate or in other areas, are going to get a look to determine whether or not the social benefit outweighs the need to get the federal fiscal structure in shape. And in a unfortunate sort of way, I think the travails in the state of Illinois are prefiguring where we could go nationally. So I would say, here's a guess. This is why Fannie Mae always makes me put a disclaimer that my comments are my own. I would say that a reasonable candidate for adjustment is the interest deduction on second homes. I would say, and the limits also on home equity borrowings, I would say that's a place there might be some action. But I think the investment of the broad middle class in housing and their use of the mortgage interest deduction suggests they are also likely voters, and that unless there's some other significant trade-off for them that overrides the valuation that they would lose in their housing, I don't see that as likely to pass at all.
Doug, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you at I Survive Real Estate again.
Thanks, and I'm looking forward to it.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate. Adrenaline Athletics, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, iMortgage, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, IRA Services Trust Company, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Lavis Tax Wealth Management, New Western Acquisition, North California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Pilot Limousine, Orange County Phoebe, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southern California Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, Tri-Counties Association of Realtors, UDirect IRA Services, Wilson Investment Properties, and Westin South Coast Plaza. To find out more about the event, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.